I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The name Henry A. Wallace stands for one of the great what-if questions of modern American history. What if Franklin Roosevelt had stuck with his vice president in 1944? What if Henry Wallace, instead of Harry Truman, had become president in 45? What if the United States had made peace or extended its alliance with the Soviet Union, broken the arms race, averted the 50-year Cold War? What if the federal government after World War II had plunged headlong into civil rights and economic justice for poor farmers and industrial workers with a New Deal for boom times? The questions are so huge that for the most part we simply ignore them. Henry Wallace, as Roosevelt's first agriculture secretary, was by all accounts the best mind in FDR's cabinet. A vice president of all jobs during the war, he was acknowledged as the assistant president. But when Roosevelt dumped him in 1944, and an impression of radical mysticism and left-wing one-worldism gathered steam, Henry Wallace began disappearing from politics and historical memory as a crank. Wallace's fellow Iowan, former U.S. Senator John Culver, has rescued Wallace in a big, vivid biography. American Dreamer, Culver calls Wallace, with emphasis on the sturdiness of that heartland vision of our country in the world. Gather round, citizens. There are important lessons here about how we think of our country and our possibilities. The connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Who remembers Henry Wallace? And who remembers, as I do, family fights among the cousins and the aunts as to whether you could vote for Henry Wallace in 1948 on the progressive ticket? 1-800-423-TALK makes the connection with Henry Wallace's biographer, John Culver. This is a wonderful book. It's a moving book. It's a really well-done piece of work for a U.S. senator to write this well. Amazing.
Well, Chris, in fairness, too, I also had a wonderful collaborator, John Hyde, the former reporter for the Des Moines Register, and we worked together very closely for 11 years.
Well, you worked well. I just want to begin with this what-if question. If he'd become president, we would, in 45, we would be living in a different world today. What would it be like?
Well, I think it clearly would have been different. Of course, how different, no one really knows. But the policy and the program that Wallace outlined for our country and his values and his belief with regard to the post-war world was really entirely different than we've experienced the last 50 years.
Could you have had a Wallace-Stalin entente, deal around the world?
Wallace was of the firm belief that if World War II was only fought for the restoration of the status quo, it would have been a failure and a tragedy. And he was the one person throughout World War II that tried to infuse and inform the war with a moral purpose. And part of that moral purpose, of course, was anticipating the century of the common man, nationalism, opening up the Third World. And he disagreed strongly with Henry Luce's conception of the post-war period as the American century, a term we still hear frequently bannered about today. And his belief countered Luce's thoughts that America's role in the world was really to exploit and impose our will and our values on the world. Wallace felt differently. He said if we have a role in the world, it's really to serve and not to dominate. And he believed that during the period at least 1945, 46, 47, and probably up to spring of 48, that given the devastation that the Soviet Union experienced in the war and the fact that they had such crying needs for all kinds of support, that if we could establish a strong United Nations, provide economic assistance, begin trade with the Soviet Union, and certainly have confidence in the ability of democracy to offer a viable alternative to communism in the world, that the prospects for a meaningful peace would be enhanced. Conversely, he felt, if we went in a direction of an Anglo-U.S. alliance against the Russians and succumbed to elements within our own government and within the Pentagon who were anxious to see us have a conflict with the Soviet Union, then in his judgment, the prospects for peace would be eliminated.
You make it sound like a very attractive alternative, Plan B. Let's try it again. See what happens.
Well, I think many of the issues, he said before World War II even began, and he was a strong supporter of Roosevelt's efforts to prepare for war, he said that the decisions we make in the first 3 years following the war will determine how we live for the next century. And that essentially is what has proven to be the case. Claude Pepper, whom we interviewed, former senator and congressman Claude Pepper, was a delegate at the 1944 convention when Wallace seconded Roosevelt's renomination with a very courageous speech directly in the face of his Southern conservative and big city boss enemies, where he called for the elimination of the poll tax. He called for equal pay for women, and he called for civil rights and so forth. And quite surprisingly, it became the most electrifying speech of the convention. It stampeded the convention. And Claude Pepper sought recognition to put his name in nomination for vice president at that point. He got to the podium through this bedlam and sought recognition. And the presiding officer, Senator Jackson, a freshman from Indiana, who had the bosses in his other ear, called for an adjournment. The nays were overwhelming, but they adjourned. Claude Pepper said the next morning he saw that senator, and Senator apologized to him because he said, "Had I recognized you, I know Wallace would have been vice president of the United States." Pepper said, had that happened, the whole future course of the world would have been changed.
Wow. This is stirring. I want you to go back and tell the story of Henry Wallace himself. He came from a family, three generations of agriculture secretaries, sort of intellectual farmers or farm journalists in Iowa. He said at an early point that what his father had taught him, and he believed that what was really important was God and agriculture.
Yes, it was an extraordinary family. I often think
God and corn, I guess, right?
Exactly. It was an extraordinary family, three generations of not only Wallaces, but of Henry Wallaces. And I think it's really quite comparable to the Adamses of Massachusetts. These were three remarkable men. The first Henry Wallace, affectionately known as Uncle Henry, was a retired minister who was well known as the editor of Wallace's Farmer, the most influential Midwest farm journal of the time. He was a national figure. They were close friends with Teddy Roosevelt. They were progressive Republicans. John Rockefeller, William Howard Taft visited their home in Iowa. Hmm. He was a member of the Country Life Commission. Roosevelt appointed him to that job, which was to make a report on how rural America could be strengthened. And he was a highly respected person, met in the Woodrow Wilson White House urging a peace after World War I. And he was followed by H.C. Wallace, Henry C., who was the Secretary of Agriculture under President Harding and Coolidge, and then, of course, Henry A. But all three men were extremely close and shared this value of the social gospel, service to your fellow man. They even had a thing called the Wallace's Covenant upon the death of Uncle Henry, when H.C. Wallace, his son and the father of our subject, stepped forward at a private family funeral and proposed a covenant where all the family members in turn got up and signed this declaration that they would live lives worthy of the values and the example of Uncle Henry Wallace. So it was an extraordinary family. And then Henry Wallace, he also, Uncle Henry, the grandfather, also warned against getting involved in politics. He said you could be far more effective from the pulpit and through education. And he also said that the highest office any Wallace had ever achieved was a sheriff in the past, and he didn't want to mar the family record.
These were all Republicans, and they were, I was surprised, they were for McKinley against Bryan in 1896. These were conservative farm people, including Henry A. Wallace, who ended the Roosevelt cabinet as a Republican, did he not?
Yes, he did. The Wallaces were never radicals. They never supported the populist farm revolution. They were totally dedicated to finding measures and means by which government could have appropriate policies to assist agriculture. They really envisioned a rural civilization. They were really more Jeffersonian. They rejected a lot of the populist and they were progressive Republicans as distinguished really from populists. And Henry A. Wallace, when he entered the Roosevelt cabinet, he didn't even get around to changing his Republican registration until March of 1936, when he changed his registration. But
so how did he become, first of all, where did his world vision come from, and how did it become isolated way out there on the left? How did he become known precisely as a dangerous radical? Harry Truman, in his diaries that you quote, called him one of the parlor pinks.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Well, first of all, when you mentioned the McKinley, 1896, Uncle Henry Wallace was asked if he was interested in being Secretary of Agriculture, and he declined and said, "You ought to name my friend Tama Jim Wilson," who, interestingly enough, was an Iowan named Secretary of Agriculture at that time, held the position for 16 years, the longest of any individual. And as a result, it's really been the Wallace's Department of Agriculture. At the end of his life, Henry Wallace, our subject, thinking back on his life, said that he didn't regret anything that had happened to him in politics. But he said, my uncle, or my grandfather, Uncle Henry Wallace, was a very wise man, because had he gone into politics, he would have suffered the same fate I did, because we shared the same beliefs, the same values. So there, it's really interesting. The fundamental faith they had in service to your fellow man, the strong religious foundation of all three of those individuals, really was reflected in their politics, I think, and in their beliefs. And beginning with the grandfather, they were very internationalist-minded. They were very liberal and progressive in their politics and in their attitudes to what constitute a worthwhile life.
Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Former Iowa Senator John Culver is our guest. His book is a big, absolutely fascinating biography of the late Henry Eggard Wallace, who was Franklin Roosevelt's vice president during World War II, dumped from the ticket in 1944, a progressive, independent, left-wing candidate in 1948, and then, to all intents and purposes, forgotten. He's back to life in John Culver's book. 1-800-423-8255. So many interesting little elements in this book, among the big ones, including the strength of mind and the freedom of people in Roosevelt's cabinet, including, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt, to speak their minds on big issues in dissent from the President of the United States during a war. Henry Wallace had a real mind. He spoke with a kind of philosophical energy about the purposes of the war as it was going on, and somewhat in doubt.
And I think Roosevelt was very reluctant to, although there, he certainly gave expression to the Four Freedoms and the Atlantic Charter and so forth, he himself, I think, having witnessed firsthand Woodrow Wilson's experience with the League of Nations, was very reluctant to talk a great deal during the war about the post-war period. Wallace, on the other hand, felt it was essential to give it a moral purpose. Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, was equally cautious about it. I think Roosevelt was afraid to detract from the Congress, the conservative elements in the Congress. And secondly, we had a period where we had a great number of dollar-a-year men brought in to help manage and direct the war domestically, who didn't believe in the New Deal, who didn't really believe in Roosevelt's domestic social program. Roosevelt was aware of that, but they were essential for the war. You recall that famous statement that Roosevelt made at one point, where Dr. New Deal is dead, and it's now Dr. Win the War.
Right.
Dr. Win the War. Wallace disagreed with that, and he disagreed with it publicly, interestingly enough.
You know, we've got to talk a little bit about his sort of active legacy. I mean, somebody like Hubert Humphrey is a kind of, not a pale carbon of Henry Wallace exactly, but a shorter giant. George McGovern, it seems to me, embodied a lot of that heartland faith. I was reading this and thinking, Henry Wallace is really the man that Warren Beatty wanted to be, a guy with real gutsy convictions about a left-wing vision of the world. But it also struck me that Henry Wallace is a kind of mirror model of Ronald Reagan, a Midwestern guy, smarter than people thought he was, who could give his own speeches, wrote his own speeches, Reagan was moving right from a Democratic family, Wallace moving left from a Republican family. But both men capable of communicating a big vision in very stirring rhetoric.
I think that's very interesting and quite apt. You know, the title of our book is American Dreamer, and he was criticized through his life of being unrealistic and a dreamer, even though he was a man of extraordinary scientific achievement, having developed hybrid seed corn that led to the Green Revolution and revolutionized world food production, saved billions of lives, perhaps his greatest single accomplishment. But for him, a dreamer wasn't a pejorative. It was to envision something that might be and could be that doesn't now exist and bring it into practical reality here on Earth. And this was really, I think, what he had in mind as a dreamer, and certainly in that regard, Reagan was of that background. Interestingly enough, George McGovern was a delegate to the 1948 Progressive Party convention, as was former Senator Quentin Burdick from South Dakota, was a delegate. Humphrey was a great admirer of Wallace, as in our book we have a very moving letter that he wrote Wallace at the time of Franklin Roosevelt's death, and said, mm-hmm. while he thought Harry Truman hopefully would do a good job, how desperately they needed Henry Wallace and his vision. Later, they had some serious disagreements during the 1948 campaign because of Humphrey involved in the Americans for Democratic Action, which had an anti-communist liberal composition. And but at the time of Wallace's death, Humphrey wrote one of the most laudatory and complimentary statements about what an extraordinary individual he was and what a good man he was.
1-800-423-8255. American Dreamer, The Life of Henry A. Wallace, by our guest John Culver. Hope is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Hope.
Yes, I was in the Department of Agriculture. I was in the New Deal part when Wallace was Secretary of Agriculture.
Uh-huh.
And then I knew about him later as a, what we thought, having been communists during that period and knowing who was influencing Wallace. We were very suspicious of, because I was no longer a communist, and I was very suspicious of Wallace's being under the influence of Lee Pressman, who had been a comrade of mine when I was a communist. And later, for instance, when Wallace came on his campaign to Smith College, where I was a faculty wife, I went to hear him speak. And someone in the audience asked him if it was true that 6 million people had been allowed by Stalin to starve. Wallace said, "Oh no, it was only 4 million." And we felt that this was a pretty good sign that he was not under legitimate influences, and We felt very sorry, because when I had been in the department, we had thought of him as a sort of mystic who had had a theoretical, mystical date with some woman that he had once been fond of. Then they would think of each other at a certain hour each day, and this was the sort of thing we talked about him, and also we talked about his fact that he didn't keep his promises.
Well, you raised some important points. First, the soft uncommunism thing. Second, this mysticism. And third, just a matter of sticking with his commitments. What about it, Senator Culver?
Well, first of all, I appreciate your call very much. It's true that Lee Pressman, and later in 1951, admitted before a congressional committee that he had been a communist. That was not known, of course, to Wallace at the time of the campaign in 1948, nor indeed in 1935, when Wallace fired, as you recall, as a member of the Department of Agriculture, the so-called liberals at that time were dismissed from the department, Jerome Frank, Pressman, Shea, Gardner Jackson, and John Apt. Wallace himself really was, of course, never a communist. He told the communists when they came to him in 1947 in July to tell Dennis, came to him for a meeting to tell him they wanted to support him for president. The meeting lasted 5 minutes, and Wallace said two things. I want you to know that I'm a progressive capitalist, and secondly, that I believe in God. And if the Communist Party wants to support my peace program, that's their business. He also said publicly during the campaign on occasion that he wished the Communist Party would run their own ticket, because if they did, it would cost him 100,000 votes, but he'd win 3 million as a result. At the same time, he felt very strongly on First Amendment principles, not to red bait. He said, I really can't be talking about peace. At that time, as you know, the Communist Party was a legitimate legal party in the country. He opposed the loyalty boards of Harry Truman. He opposed the Smith Act indictments, which later were held to be unconstitutional. And it took a great deal of courage, because he paid an awful price for that. He was subjected to all kinds of violence and eggs and tomatoes. But so much of that attack didn't really address the merits of what he was saying. He got swamped in this hysteria about communism. He felt that the democracy, those that had that attitude, really didn't have sufficient faith in democracy. He believed that we should be offering an alternative to the communists abroad, and our failure to do that, our failure to identify with reactionary regimes, only furthered communism, as did the repression of civil liberties here at home. Now, clearly, Beanie Baldwin, who was not a communist, was his campaign manager, but was very sympathetic to the Communist Party. He was sympathetic to the Communist Party role in organizing the CIO labor unions in the 30s, and certainly in their efforts in the civil rights movement in the South. In that regard, Wallace also, I think, was the first presidential candidate who campaigned in the South, refused to appear before segregated audiences, was again subjected to extraordinarily violent and dangerous situations for his courage in that regard. But it was really an albatross, the Communist Party. On the one hand, it was essential to help him get on the ballots. They were very effective in getting the signatures and so forth. And on the other hand, it really overwhelmed his message throughout the whole campaign. And it ultimately, of course, when he left the Progressive Party, 1950, August 8th, he left over the Korean War, and he worked very hard to clarify the distinction between the Progressive Party and the Communists.
But he supported the Korean War.
He supported the Korean War. He said, when the United Nations and the United States are at war, I'm on the side of the United Nations and the United States. And in the same statement, however, he warned, if we continued our identification with these reactionary regimes, that inevitably was going to be a very dangerous and disastrous situation. And in that regard, he anticipated the Vietnam War and its problems. And also throughout World War II, he had urged the decolonialization. That was one of the fundamental post-war differences.
Right.
Get the French out of Indochina, the British out of India, and compete with the communists on economic principles that he felt we were far stronger to do.
Hope, thank you for getting all that started. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about our guest John Culver's biography of Henry A. Wallace. Terry is on a car phone in Jackson, North Carolina.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Terry.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm Joey Pergam, and I'm going to take the answer off the air, but I'm just curious as to, Mr. Culver, how do you think Mr. Wallace would feel about GMOs and the biotech revolution?
Good question.
Yeah. As it applies today.
GMOs being genetically modified organisms.
That's correct.
Yeah. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Well, it's an excellent question. And interestingly enough, his work in hybrid seed corn, as you imply from your question, really was the precursor to this genetic agricultural engineering activity. One of the ironies with his remarkable foresight with hybrid corn and the results, which, as I mentioned earlier, revolutionized world food production, not only here but throughout the world, one of the ironies is that when he proceeded with hybrid corn, his dream was that it would serve to provide an economic strength for rural America and help bring about the rural civilization that he and his father and grandfather had envisioned. the irony and the paradox was for Henry Wallace that while it did bring about this extraordinary transformation of the agricultural economy, it also stimulated production to the point where we were producing three times as much corn and one-third the land and so forth, and that became the greatest problem he had to deal with as Secretary of Agriculture in terms of production controls and how we manage that, and that, again, is still with us today. He was very equally interested in problems like soil conservation, where he was a leader, and in the department as well as in so many other areas. And I think as a result, this whole question of balance and moving forward, and above all, public education, which I think is at the base of so much of the misunderstanding about GMOs, and particularly overseas as well as here, and having adequate regulatory review and public understanding, and having the farmers involved as well as the manufacturers of the GMOs. I think that's an area where he would have anticipated the essentiality of getting out ahead of some of these problems and proceeding with the science, which, after all, he was a world-class geneticist, proceeding with that with caution and with respect for the other implications.
We're talking about Henry A. Wallace, who represented in a sort of way the left side of Franklin Roosevelt's brain, the left side that lost out to the right side in Harry Truman in the vice presidential choice of 1944. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com.
From Boston University.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Vice President Henry Agard Wallace was dumped from Franklin Roosevelt's ticket in 1944. He ran for president himself against Harry Truman in 1948. And in the campaign, he said the problem in the world wasn't the Reds, it was the so-called made-up Red issue.
I am committed to stopping the creation of fear, to using all my powers to prevent the fear makers from clogging the minds of the people with the red issue. Millions know, and millions more must see, that it is not the Kremlin, not the communists who have sent milk to 24 cents a quart and meat to $1.30 a pound, that it is the red issue and not the Reds who did this to us.
Henry Wallace spoke out loud about fascists in America taking over the government, taking over the country, even during the war. He said we had a fascist problem here at home. Senator John Culver, what about it?
Well, I think, as he later explained, what he meant by fascism were people that put power and greed in front of the general welfare, as he felt was so essential and so much a part of his own philosophy. And, of course, he was concerned during World War II, as many, many liberals were, that in the prosecution of the war, that the conservatives from Wall Street, as well as the military, were having a very powerful position. He even warned Roosevelt that the rumors and gossip were that they really were quite comfortable now with Roosevelt, that that the New Deal and the social programs of the New Deal were no longer perceived to be part of Roosevelt's agenda. And he was concerned that in the post-war world, that these elements, as he saw them, would begin to dominate and really define our foreign policy. He also saw elements there who really had a warlike attitude toward our relations with Russia and were anxious to see a conflict with the Soviet Union immediately after the conclusion of World War II. Those were developments and factors that did concern him.
We're talking about what might have been an entirely different world if Henry Wallace had stayed on the ticket in 44, become president in 45. John Culver, I'm fascinated that you mention his sort of anticipation of Vietnam. When Franklin Roosevelt was alive, I mean, the thought was that Ho Chi Minh and the anti-colonial regimes would be recognized by the United States after the war. Of course, the right side of Roosevelt's brain prevailed on that instance, too. I wish you'd talk a little bit about that disagreement with Henry Luce about the American century and the century of the common man. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a question, really, that hasn't died 50 years later.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. That I think at times Roosevelt certainly tilted in that direction. It was of concern to Wallace that sometimes he wasn't all that consistent. For example, Churchill asked him not to send troops into India, and Churchill was very opposed to what was happening there in terms of Indian independence. And so it was a continuing concern to Wallace to reinforce Roosevelt's inclinations in that regard. With regard to his most famous speech in 1942, May 8th, during the war, commonly referred to as the Century of the Common Man speech, was Wallace's answer to Henry Luce's call for an American century at the end of the war. In a lengthy editorial that was published in early 1941, the publisher of Time and Life had advocated that U.S. intervention in the war, now this is before we got into it, precisely because it would leave America in a position of unparalleled power. He said that it had become our time to be the powerhouse, and that we must accept wholeheartedly our duty and our opportunity to exert upon the world the full impact of our influence, and he even went so far as to say, for such purposes as we see fit and by such means as we see fit. And I think we hear the term the American century bannered about quite commonly today, and we also hear it in reference possibly to the American millennium. Wallace never mentioned Luce by name, but his rebuttal was clear, and this is from our book. He said, "Some have spoken of the American century. I say that the century on which we are entering, the century which will come out of this war, can be and must be the century of the common man. Older, no nation will have the God-given right to exploit other nations. Older nations will have the privilege to help younger nations get started on the path to industrialization, but there must be neither military nor economic imperialism. The methods of the 19th century will not work in the people's century, which is now about to begin." And he went on to say that economic slavery and colonialism must be abolished, and that international cartels serving American greed and the German will to power must be subjected to international control. And finally, he said something to the effect that when the time of peace comes, the citizen will again have a duty, the supreme duty of sacrificing the lesser interest for greater interest of the general welfare. People must think of the whole world. There can be no privileged peoples. And finally, we ourselves in the U.S. are no more a master race than the Nazis.
Mm. I mean, and to be very blunt about it, he also said in September 46, the real peace treaty we need now is between the United States and Russia. We're talking about a very different view of almost everything.
He believed very strongly that there was nothing in our history between the Russia and the United States and our strategic interests. There was no difference that could not be resolved peacefully and certainly would not necessitate war and a conflict. And there was no sacrifice of our respective interests that had to be sacrificed, our self-interest, our national interest in a Cold War. And he believed there was a window of opportunity, again, from roughly 1945 to 48, when Russia was so devastated, that we could move together and, by having a strong United Nations, have a cooperative and peaceful change in the entire world. And, of course, that was his desire. That was his dream.
Former Senator John Culver of Iowa is our guest as the biographer of Franklin Roosevelt's wartime Vice President Henry Agard Wallace. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Greg is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Greg. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good.
Just calling. I actually come from the Midwest and kind of view myself kind of out of an old right anti-interventionist, some would call isolationist position. And of course, at that time, before the war, both the left and the right were some of the leaders in the anti-interventionist movement. But, of course, the left changed dramatically when Hitler invaded Russia. All of a sudden, the left believed now we had to get involved in the war. And I think Henry Wallace was a part of that, and I'd like to hear your comments about that. And then also about Yalta and the fact that Wallace was at Yalta with Alger Hiss, who then got on an airplane and flew after Yalta got on an airplane and flew to Russia and received the Medal of Honor. There's a lot of issues that I don't know that Wallace was directly a part of, but certainly within the left about our entry into the war, about our conduct during the war, and then about being concerned about fascists being throughout the government when we now know that it was communists that had massively infiltrated large parts of the government. So I'd love to hear some discussion about that.
Well,
Greg, thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. First of all, Henry Wallace was a very strong advocate for interventionism and supporter of Roosevelt's efforts to prepare the United States for World War II. Unlike the other progressives, La Follette, Senator Norris of Nebraska, Borah, all of whom were opposed to American intervention, Wallace was an outspoken interventionist. It was one of the principal reasons that Roosevelt picked him in 1940. For if anything happened to him, he was confident that Wallace would carry out his, not only his domestic program, but his international program. Secondly, during the war, Wallace was the first vice president to be given a serious and important executive branch responsibility. He became head of what's called the Board of Economic Warfare that was charged with ensuring that America had access to vital natural resources and also had them denied to the enemy at the time. And it's one of the things that Wallace was most proud of in terms of war mobilization. And, of course, also when I mentioned earlier this fascist business, he was talking about really certain elements in the country and in the party who were very reactionary in their politics. Now, Henry Wallace was not at Yalta. He wasn't vice president then. He had been nominated by President Roosevelt to be Secretary of Commerce, and that nomination was pending when Roosevelt went to Yalta. But Henry A. Wallace was no longer vice president, had nothing to do with Yalta.
He did say, did he not, that we have no more business in Eastern Europe than the Soviet Union has in Latin America?
Yes, that was a speech he made in September 1946, and it was the speech that ultimately resulted in his being fired by Harry Truman. And it's an interesting incident because in about the time from 1945 April until that speech, September 46, Wallace in his diaries made clear that he'd never had a disagreement with Harry Truman. Mm-hmm. And on this particular speech, he was asked to speak before a large Madison Square Garden audience of largely liberals, unions, and so forth, important to the 46 congressional election. He sat down with Harry Truman in the White House and went over line by line this speech on foreign policy in which he was urging a more conciliatory approach to the Soviet Union and some opposition to the get tough policy, which he felt would only result in the Soviets getting tougher. And as he went through it line by line with Truman, and Truman told him, yes, that's exactly what I believe. And Truman and Wallace said, may I say that in the speech? And Truman said, yes. Mm-hmm. He went up there and made this speech. And James Burns, the Secretary of State at the time, along with Senator Vandenberg and Senator Connally, were in a conference with the Soviet Union in Paris and taking a hard line. And they fired back a cable and said you could only have one Secretary of State at a time. Hmm. Whereupon Truman had another press conference and said that he had agreed that Wallace could make the speech, but not its content. Wallace called Truman and said, I understand why you had to lie. And the press had a field day because Truman apparently didn't know what his own foreign policy was. Truman said to Wallace, please come in, let's talk. I don't want to lose either you or Burns. Following a 2.5-hour meeting, Wallace went out and said, I've agreed not to make any foreign policy speeches for another until the conference is over. And at that point, a few days later, Truman actually fired Wallace.
1-800-423-8255, the story of Henry Agard Wallace. Pat is calling from Martha's Vineyard.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Pat.
Yes, hi, Chris. Hello, Senator.
Hi.
I've done a good bit of work on Henry Wallace's leadership on the issue of civil rights. And I'm so excited about your book, which I've read about but haven't read yet. But it seems that what you're doing is restoring Wallace to his rightful place in 20th century American history. I mean, he was the one leading national political figure, really singular, to understand and speak to the interrelationship between civil liberties issues, the struggle for civil rights and social justice. And I think it's important to remember that people like Charles Hamilton Houston, who was the architect of the NAACP legal campaign, supported Wallace. Daisy Bates supported Wallace. And this has been overshadowed, really, in political history in the past with this great emphasis on anti-communism. And I was wondering, I saw Arthur Schlesinger's review of your book in the Los Angeles Times, and he is still beating this drum. And one of his criticisms, I mean, he praises the book, but he criticizes the book for failing to privilege the ADA's critique of Wallace's refusal to embrace a domestic anti-communism program. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that and on, you know, the sort of the prevalence of sort of this vital center approach and the extent to which your book and your study of Wallace and his full history challenges that.
Well, thank you for your call, and I appreciate your kind words. I thought that given the history that Mr. Schlesinger had with the ADA and the liberal movement at that time, the anti-communist liberals, that it was a rather favorable review of our book in terms of how complete and well-researched he thought it was. But having said that, I certainly believe that, as you suggest, that Henry Wallace paid an awful price to be the principal defender of the First Amendment. And history has proven him to be correct. The loyalty boards were acknowledged by Clark Clifford to be the great, in his own memoirs, to be the greatest mistake of the Truman administration. They were implemented and adopted in, frankly, a political effort to deflect the anti-communist forces that had surged in 1946 campaign. And certainly the Smith Act, as we know, has become unconstitutional. The ADA, you know, as opposed to the Progressive Party positions on those issues, were in the other camp. And they were even in the other camp on the Dennis decision, which upheld the Smith Act in 1951. And, of course, I don't think there's ever been a more courageous candidate for president example than Wallace's foray into the South. One of our chapters is Am I in America? And he was subjected to, and he said he saw the face of fascism firsthand. And
but yet, Arthur Schlesinger, I haven't read the review, but it sounds as if he's still fighting the fight that you had to ward off communists and communist suspicion to be viable in this country.
Now, what he said was, in response to the listener's call, he said that perhaps we hadn't paid enough attention to the principled position of the anti-communist liberals. And frankly, with all respect, I think the principled position was that of Henry Wallace on the First Amendment, because that's the issue. And as awkward and difficult and politically costly as it was, Wallace's adherence to that fundamental principle, which again was later upheld in all these cases, was really the most American act, and it was most consistent with our Bill of Rights. And in terms of a viable, strong democracy, it was the most essential possible right to uphold, in regards to the consequences.
But as another caller said, I mean, he grossly underestimated the crimes of Stalin. Did he not see the communist world through kind of rosy glasses?
Well, I think unquestionably there was an element of naivete. Certainly he accepted certain representations. I think in response to the earlier caller's comment about the Stalin crimes, the number of people lost in the Ukraine and the famine and so forth, and the political crimes of Stalin, frankly, that wasn't well understood or well appreciated in terms of American public and understanding. I know in 1945 and 46, we tend to forget in our book, we relate a conversation that Wallace had with Truman where he said he'd like Stalin. I mean, Truman said he liked Stalin. He thought he could work with him. He would support a loan to the Soviet Union and so forth. That was right up to this period of 1945-46. So really, it's hard to reinvent and reestablish the exact context and climate of that period from this distance.
Fair enough. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Henry Wallace connection. Ray is calling from Carthage, New York.
Yes.
Welcome, Ray.
Congratulations on another excellent program today. Very timely, because today is the anniversary of the death of Franklin Roosevelt, and thinking of the consequences that might have been. You must keep...
Ray, thank you for noticing, and thank you for reminding us. Yeah.
You must keep in mind the difference between what we know now and what we knew then. I was just back from the war and a student at a university in Nebraska at the time, and got caught up in the fever of the campaign. The enthusiasm of the veterans who came back from the war was just monumental, and those who campaigned for Wallace seemed to be the most fervid. They were crusaders, and I believe I fell in with them. It was an eye-opener in education, political education, because I learned from it the futility of third-party politics in the United States, and it just... I have in front of me The Wallaces of Iowa, the book by Russell Lord on that. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read the comment that Henry made when he stepped down in 1946 and became editor of the New Republic. He said, "I shall have the opportunity of saying exactly what I think at a time when a bipartisan bloc mouthing the phrase one world is really driving the world into two armed camps." He was a man of vision, and I'm grateful that your book brings that out.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
I appreciate your call. I on the third party issue, what is interesting, the Progressive Party, which, of course, has been subjected to condemnation and ridicule in terms of the 48 campaign. The interesting thing is that the platform that was advocated at that time, almost all the most important features of that platform have now been adopted by the American political process. The second thing is that even though the third party effort in that occasion, and I agree with you normally as to the futility of many of these efforts, the significant thing to note, and it was noted by a Wall Street Journal, no friend of the Progressive Party, that in making the third party run, Wallace forced Truman to the left. And Truman and the administration, as part of their strategy, ended up in the course of that campaign, adopting almost all of the, so many of the Progressive Party proposals. And so at the end, that unlike most third parties, where there's usually a substantial delay in time before the assimilation or the adoption of some third-party progressive proposal, in this instance, the impact was immediate in terms of the domestic side of the 48 Progressive Party campaign and its influence on the actual winner of that campaign, even though on the foreign policy side that was not true.
John Covey, you're a wonderful writer and historian, it turns out, but a very practical politician, too. You know Washington well. When will we feel that kind of confident liberal vision? When will it come back out of the closet again in American politics?
Well, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with Henry Wallace, the thing that I found so compelling about his life, the political side of his life, was the courage and conviction of his ideas and the vision that he brought to them and the willingness to sacrifice himself in pursuit of those ideals in the interest of his country.
It's a wonderful story. John Culver, thank you. The book is called American Dreamer, the story of Henry Agard Wallace. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Crotchet Mountain Foundation, a 60-year tradition of helping children and adults with disabilities achieve optimal growth and independence. By JAR.